I would like to, first of all, acknowledge my co-authors on this presentation, and today I'll be talking to you about environmental issues associated with the reuse of CAFO wastewater. And in contrast to municipal wastewater, CAFO wastewater has very little treatment. And so there's going to be other issues that we have to look at with CAFO wastewater. Concentrated animal feeding operates generate a lot of waste. It's been estimated that 500 million tons of manure are generated annually at CAFOs, and that these CAFOs use 1% of the total freshwater withdraws. These large volumes of manure containing waste also occur as a result of washing the animals and stormwater runoff. And this waste is typically stored in lagoons before being land applied. Now, for the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about the composition of different types of waste. And these are different lagoon waters and various parameters from these lagoon waters that were measured by the EPA. And what I'd like to talk about initially is just the salt loads that are found in different CAFO wastewaters. For irrigation use, there are typically severe limitations on using irrigation waters that have ECs above 3 decisiemens per meter. And as you can see in this first column here, if I can get the slide to come, is that you have very high salinities associated with these CAFO wastewaters. Salinity can pose an important problem because it can alter the soil physical and chemical properties as well as crop yields. Another issue associated with CAFO waste are the high levels of nutrients and organics are found in these waters. This is the total kaldal nitrogen in these different lagoon waters, the total phosphorus, and the total organic carbon. And just for reference, the drinking water standard for nitrate, let's say, is 10 parts per million. And you can see that the total kaldal nitrogen in these samples are much higher than that. Now, high levels of nutrients and organics in CAFO wastewater have been associated with a variety of problems, including algal blooms, reduced biodiversity, ejectable taste and odors, growth of toxic organisms, and major kills of freshwater species. It's also been associated with increased risk of different diseases and illnesses. There are also a variety of heavy metals that are found in CAFO lagoon water. Heavy metals are sometimes given to the animals to promote growth. For example, arsenic is sometimes fed to chickens, and copper and zinc are sometimes fed to swine. This can lead to problems of potential phytotoxicity and surface and groundwater contamination. And just for reference, you can see that in the swine here, we do have high levels of copper and zinc, and these are the limits that are typically imposed on copper and zinc for irrigation water. There are also a variety of hormones that are found in lagoon water. And these list some estrogen-type hormones and their degradation metabolites and the different concentrations. These hormones can be highly potent endocrine-disrupting chemicals. They can affect the reproduction of fish and other aquatic species at very low concentrations, at concentrations ranging in the order of 1 nanogram per liter. And you can see in these tables here that the concentrations are significantly higher than at the nanogram per liter range. There are also a variety of antibiotics that are found in CAFO lagoon water. Antibiotics are given to the animals as a therapeutic for growth improvement and for animal health. The antibiotics are designed to pass through the animals. So we have as much as 80% of the antibiotics are found in their waste that as parent products. This can pose an important risk due to the formation of antibiotic-resistant organisms and by altering the natural ecosystem functions. And there are also a variety of pathogenic microorganisms in CAFO lagoon water. What I've shown here are just indicator organisms that are found in very high concentrations, you can see, in the different lagoon waters. So there are a variety of viruses, bacteria, and protozoan parasites in animal waste that can affect human and animal health. You may be familiar with the recent E. coli outbreak on spinach. This has been associated with contaminated water that contains manure constituents. And this led to a huge economic impact in a variety of illnesses. It's been estimated that pathogenic E. coli infections cost the U.S. economy more than $1 billion per year. And it's also been estimated that pathogens in groundwater can lead to as many as 5 million illnesses in the U.S. per year. Now, I painted kind of a bleak picture of this CAFO wastewater, but we have to remember that, well, first of all, we depend on the CAFOs to produce products that we need. And so we need to help the farmers come up with an economically viable solution to this dilemma. There's also some potential benefits of using CAFO wastewater. It can act as a fertilizer and soil amendment that improves the physical and biogeochemical conditions of soil. And as George pointed out today, we really need to conserve high-quality water for drinking. So we need to use degraded water resources in many arid and semi-arid regions. So what is the current regulatory framework? Well, the EPA has mandated that CAFO waste and lagoon water can be applied to agricultural fields under nutrient management plans. And basically, this says that you can apply these wastes at agronomic rates for specific nutrients of concern. And these nutrient management plans are developed from state-specific NRCS guidelines. These guidelines are typically written to be protective of surface water and don't give much consideration to groundwater resources or site characterization. Now, this slide shows, well, what type of loading are we going to be applying to a nutrient management plan site if we use the previous lagoon waters that we talked about? Well, first of all, if we are going to apply the lagoon water to these sites to meet the nutrient requirements, let's say, of a crop of corn based on nitrogen as a limiting factor, then we will have to dilute the lagoon water. And that's shown in the column here indicated with a blending ratio. And in some instances, you have to dilute the water considerably just to meet the requirements of for nitrogen. But what nutrient management plans don't consider are the loads due to total salts, total metals, total estrogen hormones, total antibiotics, and total indicator microorganisms. And you can see on a 1 square meter area, if you apply this lagoon water to meet the nutrient needs of corn over a 90-day summer period with a high ET rate, you have a considerable load of all these other contaminants are added to the site. And this is what the nutrient management plans currently don't address and can be a potentially important consideration as we go forward. So let's look at the implicit assumptions of these nutrient management plan and kind of get a reality check of what our limitations are. Implicitly, it's assumed in a nutrient management plan that the water is applied to meet the potential evapotranspiration of the crop so that we have little or no surface water runoff or leaching to groundwater. If you do have surface water runoff, if you do have leaching, you can mobilize these contaminants at the site. In reality, though, we have a difficulty to accurately account for all water sources. We don't know when precipitation will occur. We can have surface water, we can have snow melt, soil water, and shallow water tables that can also, you may not be able to account for. You also have problems of non-uniform water application during flood and furrow irrigation, and this occurs as a result of spatial variability in soil hydraulic properties. You also have spatial variability in evapotranspiration. So it's very difficult to exactly apply water to meet potential evapotranspiration. Now, if you don't apply it, if you apply an excess of PET, then you will have runoff and leaching of contaminants. You also have the potential of preferential flow of water that can bypass portions of the root zone before plants can uptake this water. Now, another implicit assumption of nutrient management plans is that the nutrient, or a limiting nutrient, is of critical concern. Now, there are actually different nutrients in the lagoon water, and you can have differences in the nutrient composition of the lagoon water and the plant uptake rates. So that if you assume, let's say, for example, that phosphorus is a limiting nutrient, you would actually use little lagoon water, and you may have to add nitrogen as a fertilizer to meet the plant requirements. Conversely, if you assume that nitrogen is a limiting nutrient in a nutrient management plan, then you would typically apply excess amounts of phosphorus to the system, which could then pose a surface water contamination issue. Now, the other point to make here is that the biogeochemistry of nutrients is very complex, and you can have very different transport behavior of the various nutrient species. For example, if you consider ammonium, it's a positively charged cation that strongly sorbs to solids and would have limited leaching potential, whereas nitrate, which is an anion, is much more mobile and could be a potential groundwater contaminant. Now, the assumptions of nutrient management plans with regard to pathogens, it's implicit is that they will be retained in the root zone and will not survive for long periods of time. Now, this assumption may or may not be met, but in reality, the retention of pathogens is highly dependent on physical, chemical, and microbiological characteristics of the site. The literature has demonstrated that the survival of many of these pathogens can be significant and will depend on a variety of processes such as temperature, water content, and the nutrient status. You also have other issues such as a potential of regrowth of these pathogens and other factors such as size of exclusion, which could potentially enhance its transport potential relative to, let's say, chemicals or a conservative tracer. The implicit assumption of a nutrient management plan with regard to hormones and antibiotics are that they will be degraded in the root zone. In reality, most of these chemicals are hydrophobic, which will strongly sorb to the organic fraction of soils. Now, in CAFO waste, you have a very high concentration of organics in the water, so you could potentially have these hormones and antibiotics being associated with the colloidal fraction of the CAFO lagoon water. In this case, you could have the potential for colloid-facilitated transport of these chemicals. And the modeling of colloid-facilitated transport is much more complex than if it's just a dissolved phase constituent. You have to consider both the dissolved phase and the colloidal phase, and there's interactions between the air, the water, and the solid phase. Another important consideration is that these hormones and antibiotics undergo complex degradation pathways. And these degradation processes are also highly dependent on temperature, water content, nutrients, and the microbial community. Now, if you only had to consider one compound, that would be easier to deal with, but the metabolites in these degradation processes are also of significant health concern. And they possess different degradation rates and different sorption rates, and hence their transport behavior would also expected to be different. So the implicit assumption of nutrient management plans with regard to salts and heavy metals are that they will, when they accumulate in the soil, they will not impact crop yields or soil conditions. Now, in reality, we know that if you apply water to meet a potential evapotranspiration, the salts will accumulate and the heavy metals will accumulate, and they could potentially influence crop yields and soil quality. As an example, if you want to leach these salts from the profile, in some areas that may be acceptable, but in California, for example, it's not acceptable to regulators. And in Chino, California, they have made the dairy farmers pay for a desalinization plant to offset salt loads to groundwater. So what do we do about this problem? There are a couple things that we need to do. The key thing that I think that we need to do is, first of all, we need to really monitor the concentration of these contaminants at a nutrient management plan site. And then if they are building up in high concentrations and pose an unacceptable risk, then we're going to really have to use animal waste management practices and lagoon water treatments to improve the quality of the lagoon water before land applying it. So I just want to mention quickly that we are doing a couple of studies, one funded by the EPA and the other funded by the state of California, to look at the fate of different contaminants in lagoon water when we implement a nutrient management plan. One is funded by the EPA. It's a controlled site in which we very accurately apply the water, and then we monitor the fate of nutrients and pathogenic microorganisms in the soil profile over time, to see if the assumptions with regard to the nutrient management plan are being met. On the other side, the field site, it's a 70-acre site, we're also implementing the same nutrient management plan. But in this case, we have to deal with variability in soil properties, which is highlighted by the ECA map that's shown in the lower right-hand corner here. And so you have variability of soil texture occurring as well. And so you could have very different transport behavior occurring at these locations. So some of the treatments that we may have to consider and best management practices, we have to think about the location of these CAFOs. There are practices that can be implemented to minimize the source of contaminants. For example, diet may affect the number of pathogens that occur in animal waste, or the amount of antibiotics that you administer to the animals. We may have to implement solid-liquid separation techniques. There's a picture shown on the far right-hand side. And we may have to adjust our storage time of the lagoon water to optimize the settling or degradation of different contaminants before land applying it. Ultimately, we may have to implement some wastewater treatment technologies to improve the quality before land applying. So just in summary, I've tried to highlight what are the environmental contaminants, what are the issues with applying these contaminants to nutrient management plan sites, and highlight the need for monitoring and implementing maybe best management practices and treatments to improve the quality before land application. Thanks for your attention. Salt is a huge issue, and salt in groundwater. So the current regulatory environment in California, anyway, is that they want zero salt loading. But of course, we know that that's not sustainable. Ultimately, we'll have accumulation of salt. So maybe we just have to minimize the leaching and have to assure that these other contaminants are degraded or inactivated before implementing the leaching of salts.
So that's a state form.
That's a state issue.
If I could just comment, Chip's remark, in Virginia, we're dealing with a similar problem with residents, in which they want to, even with an advanced nutrient removal, which we may only have 8 parts per million nitrate in, they want zero leaching of effluent out of the root zone, because they say, well, according to them, it's any condition of any nitrogen groundwater they consider to be an impairment. So we're dealing with very often regulators who don't understand a soil plant system and the real world.
Which means you're only going to be able to apply in the summertime when you have high evaporative transpiration.
And in these cases too, you end up with no leaching fraction, and even in the humid east, build up the salts in the soil.
You know what, I'll be happy to answer your question afterwards, but I already went over time. So we have a 10-minute break right now, and then we'll come back here at 10:30.
I have a comment. This is thanks for George and Nick, I think in particular. Your concerns about analytical capabilities and measurements, if you continue along those lines, you're not going to get off the ground. The toxicologists have already decided that they can set risk numbers based on toxicology. So if they can go